The Cleveland Council on World Affairs was formed a century ago to better educate people about global issues and connect us with the wider world. In 1923, Cleveland was the fifth largest city in the country and still growing. That's no longer the case. So where will the next century take the council and the city? And are we prepared for the challenges and opportunities coming our way? To mark its centennial, the council is convening a forum to discuss those very questions. I'm Rick Jackson. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas. To begin today, we'll talk with city leaders about the upcoming forum and dive into some of the issues involved, including what it means to be globally connected in the post-pandemic world. Later, we'll hear from a recent City Club of Cleveland discussion on the changing meaning of the American Dream. The panel's guests reflected on how the concept of the American Dream translated to us, our parents, grandparents, and generations beyond. Let's make the conversation interactive by sending your questions or comments by email, text, or tweet. The discussion begins after news. It is the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. As the world continues to emerge from the pandemic era, how will cities rebound? A 2021 report from the global consulting firm A.T. Kearney found that cities with the greatest global connectivity were best positioned to navigate post-pandemic. The firm concluded that cities which are globally connected also tend to be more resilient. For 100 years now, the Cleveland Council on World Affairs has been fostering an understanding of global issues and world affairs for the people of Cleveland through education and global awareness programs. A century ago, of course, Cleveland's population doubled what it is today, ranking as then the fifth largest city in the United States. Many of our best-known organizations and cultural gems, including the Cleveland Clinic, the Cleveland Orchestra, and the Cleveland Museum of Art, were founded roughly a century ago. So what will the next century hold for our city and its future? The 100-year mark, a major milestone for any organization. So to mark its centennial, the Cleveland Council on World Affairs will host a civic forum June 8th to discuss how being globally connected impacts this city and the region across all sectors. So we're going to not wait for June, though. We'll wade into that conversation today. Joining me here in Studio 4, Corina Van Vliet. She's the Chief Executive Officer of the Cleveland Council on World Affairs. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Thanks for coming in today. Also with us in studio, Bethia Burke, the President of the Fund for Our Economic Future, moderating a panel on business and infrastructure assets. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
And Victor Ruiz, the Executive Director of Esperanza, who will moderate a panel on human capital. Victor, good to see you again.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
To join the conversation, folks, and we want you to do so, give us a call, 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can tweet us at Sound of Ideas, email us, soi@ideastream.org. Corina, first off, for folks who don't know you, give us a little history of the Cleveland Council on World Affairs goal when it was formed back in 1923 and goal now in 2023.
So at its roots, the Cleveland Council on World Affairs is about peace and democratic engagement. And so back in 1923, a group of women peace activists who had just witnessed the horrors of the First World War, they wanted to bring people together in Cleveland, and they believed that they could help promote peace through greater international understanding. And what's also fascinated, in preparation for our centennial, we benefited from the help of the Western Reserve Historical Society in going through our archives, and we found that most of these women were also suffragists, and they had just won the right to vote.
3 years earlier.
Exactly, 1919. And so they wanted to engage the Cleveland community in conversations about issues of international importance of the time. Also, they wanted to have a voice as women on international issues, which I find absolutely fascinating. And so that's how CCWA got started. It was a women's international debate groups to help promote world peace starting from Cleveland, Ohio.
I think the idea of being connected globally in 1923 and 2023 are completely different things. I mean, we can walk across the room and talk to someone in the African continent now.
Yes. And at the same time, if I think back at those women in 1923, right, they were coming out of war in Europe, which we're currently looking at now, the Spanish influenza. We're still coming out of COVID-19. And they were headed into a Great Depression. So I think they also felt a sense of great economic instability and insecurity. And I think, you know, Bethia can speak to this more, but there's a complicated global economic outlook facing us today. And they were truly worried about the fate of the world and the fate of Cleveland within the world. And, you know, this is what the Cleveland Council on World Affairs has been doing, as you just said, is finding ways with each generation to figure out how do we connect Cleveland to the rest of the world and the rest of the world to Cleveland. International engagement is a bridge. It's a two-way street. And so in as much as it's about Cleveland learning from the rest of the world, this is also truly about what Cleveland has to offer to the rest of the world. And I can't tell you, we currently connect Cleveland through the rest of the world, obviously through our speaker programs, which is sort of the continuation of these women's groups discussions. But two, we also welcome over 400 international visitors a year through the State Department exchange programs. And these are professionals who come here to talk to us about how do we do medical innovation, education, entrepreneurship, DEI, et cetera, environmental issues. And then finally, we're really focused on building the next generation of globally minded Clevelanders. We've always focused on students, whether it's our high school and middle school Model UN program and other global education programs. But right now, we're also really investing in young professionals because we feel like this generation is the one that needs to grow into global business and civic leaders, and we can build that right here in Cleveland.
Gave us a big sandwich. We'll take some bites out as we discuss. Thank you, Karina. Bethia, you're leading the discussion on business and, as I said, infrastructure assets. What's the current landscape for business? We know that things aren't as great as they were around the country, but what are we looking at?
When we think about the local outlook, Cleveland and Northeast Ohio, it's sort of middling. There's been some really important investments, a lot of thinking about things like talent and site development, and yet we know we're not growing as fast as peer places. And so that balance of making sure we're doing the focus on the long-term investments and also realizing growth gains in the near term is what we're worried about locally.
We've had conversations earlier about some of the hurdles that impact the businesses and workers here. Have those changed over the course of the last few years? As Karina was talking about the pandemic and how it's changed everything. Has our business structure changed substantially?
I guess the more things change, the more they stay the same. So some of the things are the same. We heard just coming into this program, if you were listening on your radio before we started, you know, people are still struggling with food insecurity, low wages not keeping up with inflation. And that is that's a people problem. It's also a business problem because somebody who is food insecure is less likely to be able to focus in their job, is less likely to be able to retain that job, which feels sort of counterproductive and also might not be the first thing on folks' mind. Other things have changed. Expectations of workers have changed. The ability for businesses to keep up with the way that we do business and make sure we are balancing the needs of workers and the businesses to be productive is one of the highest priorities on many people's minds.
You teed it up nicely for Victor when you talk about the idea of people. You're dealing with human capital as your conversation piece next week. And we hear reports all the time. Manufacturing needs people. Police need people. Everybody's looking for people.
Yeah, absolutely. We certainly have a lot of needs. I think one of the things we're going to definitely explore next week is, you know, what are the untapped populations that we have here in Northeast Ohio that could help fill some of those gaps, including our growing international community from a Hispanic community that's been here over 60 years and still is drawing new individuals, to the growth in refugee populations and other international communities. So how do we bring them in and leverage their talents and their desire to stay here and work here in Northeast Ohio?
We were talking with Tri-C last week on the program. Dr. Baston will join you on the upcoming panel. We know they're focused on finding the overlooked talent in the region first. Why is it important that we find what's here that's not working?
Well, because these are Clevelanders, right? These are people who were born here. This is their home and can contribute a lot to our local economy. And again, as we look at the needs of our employers, it makes sense to try to make that match, to align their needs with the talent that's here.
And while we have the talent that's here, Karina, you're also interested in, as you said, recruiting, bringing people into Cleveland. How do you hope to raise our profile so that people are going to think, I don't have to go to the Silicon Valley, I can go to Northeast Ohio?
I think it's really sort of what both Bethia and Victor are underscoring, and we hope to underscore with this civic forum on June 8th next week, is celebrating the things that we actually already do well mm-hmm. and the ways that we're already actually connected. I mean, you started this conversation by mentioning where we were in 1923 and a growing population, and we are a city of immigrants. And we're a city that was built by welcoming people here. And I think there's, when I look at the next 100 years, right, or perhaps right. just the next two or three decades, there's two things that strike me is things that Cleveland has as assets that we may want to think about how we can better leverage. And this is part of the conversation for the Civic Forum. One is arts and culture. And we already have world-class artistic institutions, but we also have things. I travel a lot internationally. I grew up abroad. And the number one global brand that Cleveland has is the Cleveland Cavaliers. And so
how more so than the orchestra.
Absolutely. And, I mean, LeBron James, you go to anywhere in the world, Cleveland Cavaliers, LeBron James.
I go to both of those places all the time, but I wouldn't have thought that.
Yes, yes. And so, yes, we have the Cleveland Orchestra and the museum and all of these turn-of-the-century centennial organizations of which the Cleveland Council of the Friends is a part. But we also have a lot of things that we could build on and leverage going forward. And the second thing that I think we should think about is climate change. And the reason for that is, yes, we should all be extremely concerned about climate change and do everything in our power to try to mitigate its impact. But scientifically, Northeast Ohio and the Great Lakes region is going to be one of the regions that is relatively going to be safer over the long term. So what can we here in Cleveland do now to plan ahead for the populations and the groups of people, our fellow Americans, and also our fellow human beings from all over the world who are going to have to leave their homes because they're no longer inhabitable and are going to want to migrate here. So I think we have a huge historical opportunity to build the kind of environment that is going to ensure the well-being and safety of our citizens for the future, and add to that elements of cultural attractiveness and all these things that precisely the A.T. Kearney report says makes cities attractive.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to pat ourselves on the back because 3 weeks ago we did a program on the water that we have that everybody wants and how people are going to be looking to Northeast Ohio and hopefully migrating here. So folks, if you want to find that program, it's online at ideastream.org. If you want to talk to this wonderful panel, 866-578-0903, let's talk about Cleveland in the future. Victor, as she talks about bringing people in, we also talked about the situation in Ukraine right now. Do you see people coming here looking at Cleveland thinking that's a place where I can start over if I have to? And Ukraine's not the only place losing folks.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is my understanding is that Cleveland's not necessarily the place they're picking. It's where they're landing. Mm-hmm. And because of really strong support network and a community that's really, for the most part, embracing and there's opportunities, people want to stay. So I know that there's a growing, obviously, Ukrainian, but also a growing Afghani population that is growing on the west side of Cleveland. And also, you know, if you take the Puerto Rican community, for example, that's been here since the 40s, maybe even earlier, there's a strong community that's here that's thriving and growing that could welcome them and embrace them.
And let's not forget what's happening in Akron, too, because they're attracting groups of their own.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
The city, Cleveland, is home to both a port and an international airport. Gives us a distinct advantage, but are we utilizing them, Bethia, as best we could?
Well, on the distinct advantage, the advantage is access to market, right? So people and businesses need to travel back and forth, even in a world where we have a lot of other ways of connecting, as you referenced earlier. People, businesses, goods need to travel back and forth. We have, for a long time, had the port has thought a lot about making sure that there is access in and out of the port. From the airport standpoint, we know that we just added an international flight, mm-hmm. international direct service to Dublin. Those are the kinds of things that are really critical when you think about the time to get back and forth. And that's not always under our control. I think people, you know, 10 years ago wouldn't have liked to have lost the hub. And there has been a lot of energy and effort in trying to rebuild those connections from an air perspective. And this recent gain is really important.
Yeah, we had that big push for Reykjavik not that long ago. Now Dublin. Is it more important that they can get to us than we can get to them?
I don't think so. No, I think that it's, as Karina said, it's back and forth, right? If you want to have a business in Cleveland and Northeast Ohio and you need that business to connect internationally, it's just as important that you're able to get out as people are able to get in.
Let's go ahead and grab a caller. Todd's on the line. Good morning. Welcome back. You're talking to the panel here. What's your thought today?
Hey, good morning, Rick and Victor. And I don't have everybody's name. Is it Bethy?
Bethia Burke and Karina Van Vliet.
Okay, and Karina. I have two questions. How do you fund yourselves? And does the Cleveland Metropolitan Schools still have a foreign exchange program? And are you involved in it?
Well, you had mentioned schools earlier.
We do work with CMSD schools. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they still have a foreign exchange program. Schools that do have study abroad programs, we try to work with them to help prepare students before they grow abroad. One of the biggest issues that Americans, anyone encounters the first time you go overseas is it's a different culture. And so what are some things that we can teach students or professionals or anyone of any age, give them some cultural background to best prepare them for that experience and make sure that they have a positive experience and that the lessons that they learn over there, they feel confident in embracing the diversity of a different culture and a different experience, and that they learn and grow from that and bring that back home to Cleveland.
His first question, how are you funded? I hadn't thought of that myself. Is it foundational money? Or?
It's a rough one-third, one-third. Foundations, private individuals in Cleveland. And also, as I mentioned, we run very robust international exchange programs in support of the State Department. And so about a third of our funding comes from the State Department.
Okay. Thank you. Victor, when we were thinking back 100 years, Cleveland was such a manufacturing hub. Where should we focus now? Where should we put our attention? Are we tech? Are we marketplace?
Good question. I definitely see, I'm tying it back to the schools. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that Cleveland schools have started a very robust career pathways program for students to expose them to the myriad of career options that are out there. One of the ones that's really growing is the tech industry. There's several schools that have tech programs starting in ninth grade. So I think that's an opportunity there. We're seeing a growth in interest from young women in tech. Obviously, a lot of the individuals are coming from other countries. So I think tech is really an area that we should explore further.
Bethy, same idea. Excuse me. Where's the fund look forward? Where are we strong right now?
There's a couple industries that the region is looking forward into. Karina mentioned climate change and the technologies that go along with that. There are people working on water and water technology. There are some questions about whether and how Northeast Ohio captures benefit from electric battery storage and production of EV vehicles. And then there's an energy incubator that is based in Youngstown called Bright that is working with companies across the region, the state, and the country on those kinds of questions. And then there are questions about, we know Intel made a big announcement. If you haven't heard about it, I'd be surprised. Intel made a big announcement that they're locating outside of Columbus. To what degree can the semiconductor industry supply chain opportunities be in and around Northeast Ohio as they are around the state?
I'm glad you brought up Intel because we do see big things happening in Columbus sometimes. Does it help us or hurt us to have things happening downstate that aren't really regional?
I mean, I think that we should focus on the local economy and making sure we're fundamentally strong, and that's what helps or hurts us. Columbus being a competitive market doesn't in and of itself help or hurt us. It's about whether we, Cleveland, we, Northeast Ohio, have the assets to attract businesses locally and to benefit from those opportunities.
Does it hurt us that they could attract some talent away that maybe we wanted to keep?
To me, again, this is about the fundamentals. They can only attract the talent away if our companies here aren't paying enough, don't have good places to work, and there aren't jobs for people to work in, and if we're not offering those training opportunities. That's about the fundamentals of being a great place to live and work, and that includes the training institution's quality of life. It also includes businesses like having high-quality workplaces.
Mm-hmm. She had mentioned the idea of climate change. I wanted to go back to that because it does bring people in here. And I asked both of your friends here, and I didn't ask you, is that something that we can leverage to our advantage?
Yeah, from a fund perspective, we are looking at the economic competitiveness aspect of what Karina brought up. I think one of the fundamental questions in our minds is, what, in addition to potentially being a climate resilient place and being on a Great Lake, what in addition do we need to do and focus on in order to make sure we're competitive in the future? We are not the only place in the United States that can say that we're on a body of fresh water and has relatively reasonable climate effects. And so thinking about things like, what is our energy policy? What is the investment in the training to get people ready for the kinds of jobs that matter? That to me is where, how do we think about how we're improving the ability for manufacturers to compete in an environment that requires them to adhere to different kinds of regulations around carbon emissions. Those are the things that if we want to be and be a more competitive place in the future, I think we should be focusing on.
What do you want people to think about for next week as we go into this forum? What are things that other topics that may come up? I mentioned the panels that you guys are hosting.
Oh gosh!
I'll throw that to her too.
Yeah, I think lots of things come up, but I mean, to me, it's the fundamentals that we've talked about, and then these differentiated business assets. So, how do we grow and build our international connections? I would imagine would be one of our discussion points.
Karina, it's your forum. So, what are other things that people maybe should be thinking about now and thinking, you know, I can still register, I can still take part.
Absolutely, can still register on our website, sisterread.org. So thank you for that, Rick. But I think what we're hoping to get out of this forum is precisely the conversation that we've initiated here this morning. And so thinking about, what are our fundamentals and how do we build from there? And how do our international connections benefit us? Can we get some specificity around those benefits? And can we together figure out how we want to best position ourselves for the future? Very much along the lines of what Bethia said, but not just in terms of business, in terms of growing world-class talent and welcoming world-class talent to Cleveland, and also taking those two areas that I talked about, building the kind of environment. The A.T. Kearney report basically says, you know, it's about global competitiveness.
Right.
And so it's about having a growth mindset. And what the research shows, it's about our ability to attract and retain capital, people, and ideas, and do this over time. So how do we take that notion and what do we want to focus on and prioritize going forward?
We touched really briefly on the digital economy. Is that something that we have embraced to the level that some of the, quote, global cities have embraced, or do we need to step up our game?
I mean, I don't know if we've embraced it to the degree other places have, but I think it is something that people are paying attention to needing investment. And we know that there was a big chunk of money that went into Digital C to make sure that we have increased connectivity. It's something that's been an issue for a long time. Making sure that we have affordable, maintained access to broadband is a fundamental competitiveness issue, both for people and for businesses. So, I think it's... having the mindset of being a modern place that's open for business helps us make the investments in the kind of continuous infrastructure needs that we'll have over time. That's not going to be the last thing that needs to happen, right?
Does the fund invest in individual community well-being in a way that it's really going to bring everybody forward? Or are there specificity? I don't know how you invest.
So our headline objective is a growing Northeast Ohio economy with good jobs and rising incomes for all, regardless of race or place. So it's a long statement, but really it's about people benefiting from the economy, and that people benefiting from the economy means that access to opportunity is there, whether you are a Black resident, a Hispanic resident, a white resident, a female, male, that there's access to that economic opportunity. Historically, that's not been true. And we can see that in the data. We can see that in unemployment outcomes. We can see that in income outcomes. We can see that in wealth outcomes. And so our focus is bringing good jobs that benefit people. And that we do those investments that we make. I've talked a lot about fundamentals today. The investments that we make are geared towards the long-term change that needs to happen in order to see the day-to-day headlines that you see when we have a company landing here or a person getting a good job.
Okay. Karina, wrap it for us here. We used to call the 20s the roaring 20s. 100 mm-hmm. years later, can we be the roaring 20s again?
I think that's entirely up to us. I think we can. I think as we've all discussed, I think if, to Bethia's point, we focus on fundamentals, and I think we also, a word that came, we spent quite a bit of time preparing for these conversations, and another word that came up a lot besides growth mindset is inclusion. And so we have a historic opportunity, whether it's roaring or it's going to be strategic and deliberate, mm-hmm. however we choose to define it for ourselves, I do think we have this opportunity. And what the council wanted to do was invite conversation from our fellow Clevelanders.
Thank you so much for being here today. That is Karina Van Vliet from the Cleveland Council on World Affairs. Bethia Burke is here from the Fund for Our Economic Future. Victor Ruiz of Esperanza here as well. You can find a registration link to the Centennial Civic Forum hosted by the Cleveland Council on World Affairs on their page or on our show page today. And again, that event is free. Thank you all.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right here. When we return, we'll hear an excerpt from a recent conversation I moderated about Cleveland's cultural DNA and the American Dream. It was part of the Humanities Festival put on by the Cleveland Orchestra. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We'll be right back. And you're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thanks for being here. The American Dream Festival, created and staged by the Cleveland Orchestra earlier this month, in partnership with a pantheon of co-sponsors, aspired to engage conversation from different perspectives about the relevance of the American Dream today. I moderated a panel discussion on Saturday with a diverse group of city leaders called Cleveland's Cultural DNA and the American Dream, Past, Present, and Future. The forum was put on in partnership with the City Club of Cleveland, Case Western Reserve University, and IdeaStream Public Media. We ask our guests and the audience to reflect on how the American Dream translates to us, our grandparents, parents, generations beyond. When they came to America, perhaps came from here, what opportunities or difficulties did they find? The panel included Dr. Regina Williams, a historian of African-American culture and history at the Western Reserve Historical Society, Cynthia Connolly, the director of programming at the City Club of Cleveland and a member of the Lake Erie Native American Council, Michael Jeans, the CEO of Growth Opportunity Partners, Marsha Moreno, the founder and president of Amore Consulting, and Karis Zhang, the vice president of planning at Midtown Cleveland. Now, this conversation was pre-recorded back on Saturday, so we can't take phone calls, but please feel free to send your thoughts via email, soi@ideastream.org. We begin the excerpt as I'm asking Cynthia Connolly about the concept of the American Dream from an indigenous person's perspective, taking into account the historically fraught relationship between Native communities and the American government.
When I think of the American Dream, I mean, I think of several core values, right? I think of prosperity, equity, a governing structure that supports everybody. I think of the ability to make decisions and make the next generation stronger and better than the one before. And those are all things that were very central to our culture and our form of governance for indigenous people. We had the American Dream, those values that we consider the American Dream. We had that for tens of thousands of years here on these lands. It was disrupted, and very recently disrupted when we think about how long our history is here versus where we were since the start of colonization. And from that period, about 500 years of just completely like opposite policies that targeted our identity and who we are as a people, our power to define ourselves, to control our image, it often flip-flopped those federal policies, and they were very intentional at either removing us, total genocide, or assimilation. And we see this happen over a period of 500 years, and there's a bunch of scholarship you can look at about these different eras of federal policy. But there's one specific era of federal policy that directly impacts Cleveland. And when I moved here, everyone's like, why are there no tribes here? I'm like, I think you can, there's probably a reason why there are no tribes here. Can you think of one, right? And it was removal, and it was genocide. And during the 1950s to the 1970s, there was this era called the Termination Era. And it was an era where federal policy directly targeted Native tribes to kind of work them into mainstream society. So again, for hundreds of years, their idea of what how to deal with the quote-unquote Indian problem was either genocide, assimilation, or removal. And this was assimilation. There was 8 cities in the United States that were targeted as destination cities to move Native American families from the reservation. And again, they were very prosperous Native tribes until they were moved into the reservation, until about 1880, during the Dawes Act, where they plotted out this land and gave it away to settlers and pushed us onto the reservations. That's when we started to see deep poverty, like really true deep poverty. And then they realized, well, maybe if we just make them into everybody else, then we won't have to deal with the poverty on the res, right? We won't have to deal with the Indians anymore if they're just like us. And so we ended up moving. There was an actual federal policy and program that literally bused Native Americans from reservations to 8 select cities. Cleveland was one of those cities, and it was chosen specifically because there were tribes in the state, it's distance from tribal communities, and they actually called it recidivism when Native participants went back to the res, because their goal was to keep us here and to incorporate us into mainstream society. We're now in about the 4th generation since that program. It's a double-edged sword. It was the advent of a lot of pan-Indian identity, and also realization that, you know, this is the first time a lot of tribal communities were seeing other people from other tribes, and like, oh wait, you're experiencing that too? Yeah, so are we. Like, what's up with that? And that's when you've seen like American Indian movement, a lot of these civil rights programs and movements launch up. And we're now here today in what, a year and a half out since the Cleveland baseball team name change. And I can tell you in my leadership role in this community, this is the first time in our entire time being here since the start of relocation, since we really, you know, a lot of Natives have returned to Cleveland, that we've had the ability to control our identity and our image. We have not had that ability, period, 4 generations in this city. And in this year and a half since we started that, since the name change, a lot of opportunities have opened up for our community in ways that we have not seen for decades. And so I think that is a proof how imagery and identity can really control how a group of people are able to achieve that American dream.
Thank you. Michael James, we heard from Isabel Wilkerson last week, and I hope you were all able to see that, about America pre-1796, what this place was, the dream of what it could become. Dr. Williams painted part of that picture again today of northward migration, even before the phrase American dream came into our lexicon. Talk to us about what people found when they arrived, largely from the South. Life for African Americans certainly was not the American dream as it was envisioned.
Absolutely, and thank you for that question. You know, this notion of American a dream, I think, was well described just a moment ago by Cynthia. You know, there were images and pictures and thoughts and a bit of an indoctrination on what an American dream would be, but I struggle intensely on this notion of American dream. And I struggle for a number of reasons. And one, I'm going to do a 30,000-foot flyby because my colleague Marcia is going to drill down on it, but the Americas, you know, extend from the north of Canada to the south of South America. And this country has a long history of co-opting things that belong to others. And so the bit of arrogance to call this America, I think, is a good starting point, as we're the United States, but the Americas span far greater, far more broad. Secondly, we should all issue great caution when prescribing and dictating what someone else's dream should be. And so when you put these together, I have immense struggle in what an American dream should be and whether it should be pursued. And so you read in the booklet that was provided a bit of history in 1931 and some early usage of this. But we found that the phrase was actually used before 1931. In 1899, a doc out of Vermont built a lavish home. I think it was on 4,000 acres and 60 rooms. And the media picked it up, press picked it up, and it wasn't well received. It was tagged to be, and I wrote this down so I wouldn't forget, it was tagged to be an utterly un-American dream. Because the early impetus for this American dream was about democracy. It was about things that were not material. But over time, it would be redefined. And it would be redefined as a pursuit of things. And I'm going to pass by that too. The following year, the New York Post declared that the greatest risk to every republic was discontented millionaires. This starts to ring familiar, right? From the busing scenarios you shared to the busing that African Americans experience, we're seeing old playbooks replayed, pages taken out and reused by the same cast of characters. And so I'll end with, you know, what did we find? America has a long history of floating red herrings, right? And then operating in an opposite manner. And we've got to recognize this and call it out for what it is, a Declaration of Independence that was bold in declaring inalienable rights, right? Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. But it would be followed by deed restrictions, be followed by burning and bombing of prominent black communities, like Tulsa and like Redwood and 56 others. So are these rights essentially granted? My question is, if there is a thing called the American dream, then who owns it? And who has the authority to dole it out? There's a First Amendment that's to protect free speech, assembly, and peaceful protest. But January 6th was treated starkly different than Black Lives Matter. And so is there a freedom and a liberty in the pursuit of such things? The Second Amendment allegedly gives us all the right to bear arms, but right here in Cleveland, in May of 2022, an African-American male, Antoine was his first name, he after being fatigued in the violence that was plaguing his neighborhood, he took on his right to bear arms, only to be arrested for bearing arms and for inciting some kind of unrest in his community. And so I struggle with what this American dream is and who owns it. Lastly, I'll say free markets and capitalism, they've been capped with redlining. They've been capped with someone telling people who look like me where we can live, where we can play, where we can loiter. We had to fight to play in the ocean. Whose ocean is it to give? We were arrested for taking our kids to the lake. And I guess as I think about this, I'll share as Dr. Williams did, I'm sharing the black experience. I guess what fatigues me even greater is that experience continues to persist for natives, for Latinos, and for Asian Americans. And King highlighted that this would be a flaw for us. This would be a challenge, that if we permit these inequities, these injustices for one group, that we'll all suffer. I'll close with, this country has a long way to go before it achieves greatness, because we have to see each other as brothers and sisters. And until that happens, we're going to keep toggling this baton back and forth. We can't outrun the natives, can't outrun blacks, can't outrun Latinos, and we can't outrun Asians and others. So we didn't migrate into the fullness of what was promised coming from the South. And in some ways, we're still looking for it.
Thank you. In the program for the festival, we see Cuneo Harris' piece that tells us the idea of the American dream, the aspiration for social improvement and upward social mobility attained through individual hard work, turns out to be resilient and adaptable. Dr. Williams, is it still that way, resilient and adaptable?
We hear phrases like, and they don't really make sense when you go to places like China and you see that there's so much diversity in that part of Asia. But phrases like the model minority, and very often they're talking about Asian students mm-hmm. at places like Harvard and Yale and how they outperform almost everybody else, including black males, and challenges to affirmative action related to those high achieving Asian American students. I think it is adaptable, right? The stereotypes that are applied to certain groups in the society, very often they were negative stereotypes when we talk about African Americans coming from the South, regardless of the level of educational attainment, always looked upon as being less than, very often earning less money
teachers especially in the segregated schools of the pre-civil rights era, earning sometimes half of what their white counterparts were earning in the American South. So I do believe that it is adaptable. Groups, I see other groups beyond the African American community demonized for being, or they are othered, if I can say that. They don't appear to be American enough, if we can say it that way. And so again, we're in the 21st century, but I think we are reliving not the American dream, but the nightmares of the first half of the 20th century when we look at the experiences of people of color, especially in non-English speaking groups in the society.
Kara Singh was nodding her head. For Asian people, the first American dream out west, people came there from the Far East because of the gold rush. The dream wasn't realized. AAPI people were set upon. Many elected to move east, Ohio being just one of those destinations. Celebration of culture they imported had to be hidden at times. But the dream of an American Chinatown, or Asia Town here in Cleveland, as we called it, sprouted regardless, but with a lot of difficulty.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Dr. William, for bringing up, I think, with the model minority method. And to your question too, Rick, I think we create these images, but we forget that, you know, for folks who are coming to the States to be students, they're accepted, right? And so we create this model minority myth that's based on this selection criteria that has been created, and then we create this larger stereotype of this is an entire race of people and how they are to look or behave or to be. And I think, you know, when I think about Asiatown and Chinatown here in Cleveland, so the history of Chinatowns is actually similarly created out of necessity. So a lot of our Chinese folks who maybe in all over the United States, whether on the West Coast or here in Cleveland, weren't allowed to live in most places. Michael talked about deed restrictions. I think similarly in San Francisco and the Chinatown there, all these neighborhoods were created because Chinese people weren't allowed to live or to work or to even go to the hospital at the white institutions, and so they created their own. And so these neighborhoods rose out of the necessity of creating our own communities. Even family associations were raised in this style of mutual aid to support one another, to help each other find housing or to learn English or to find jobs. And so in Cleveland, something that really strikes me is that first Chinatown was actually right next to Public Square and was displaced for the building of a federal building. And so I think a lot of times we talk about Chinatowns as disappearing or as kind of dissipating, but in reality, often displaced for highways or for federal projects. And in Cleveland, we see that as the case too. Many of you, I think, will recognize Rockwell Avenue as kind of, we think of the historic Chinatown, and thinking about the separation from where we see Asiatown today and its growth and its development a little bit east of there, and how, you know, I think that disconnection is part of that, is by design of hemming in. I think some people might have seen even today, actually in Philadelphia, I was in Philadelphia's Chinatown for a little bit, and so it's close to my heart. But actively right now, that Chinatown is fighting against the development of a basketball arena right on the boundaries of the neighborhood, and so further hemming in and displacement of these communities. And so today in Asiatown, I think we see a fight to say we are here, that the history has been to be made invisible, to be shaped as a model minority. Or I know growing up here, I was often told, well, you're not really Asian, like you're basically white, because of this picture that we have created of what it means to be Asian, and really this flattened image. And so I think in my work at Midtown Cleveland in community development, something that we've shaped for Asiatown with the community, we heard a lot of this desire to be seen, to be recognized, and to be able to have a place to feel belonging and celebration. And so there's this kind of vision of saying we're growing home, and we're collectively creating the space here that can be our home, where we can feel a place of belonging, of celebration, where our identity can be uplifted in many different ways that can look. Asia is a very large place, and many different cultures in that can be celebrated.
Thank you. Marcy Marino,
Go ahead.
They really like you. Marcia, the dream for the Latino community, still also very much a work in progress. Unlike some of the other backstories we hear, though, most of this community did not flee here, was not displaced here, but chose to come here to resettle. Very different kind of an American dream.
Yes, and I relate to so many of the stories and what we're talking about today. I guess I want to make sure that my disclaimer is that, yeah, there might have been some displacement, because one of the biggest issues of the Latino community is that we are just bottled and labeled under this umbrella of Latino. When we're so many different countries and territories, and I think that's part of what it's hard to deal with us in a way, because we come here and suddenly we become Latinos. That's not even a word that we use to identify ourselves when we live in our countries, but here we are, right, in the country that loves putting us in a box and categorizing everything. So I guess what I wanted to say about that, I'm sure that there are other groups that have been displaced that can self-identify as Latinos. My perspective and my part of the story and the reason why I do the work I do with my consulting is because many of us have chosen to come here for various reasons. And the American dream, well, first of all, I'm an American too, because I live in Chile, right? So that was my first argument with my husband that, okay, what do you mean you're American? I am an American too. And it was, you know, an interesting starting conversation for dating, I guess. But so the American dream, it's a slightly different, I guess. I came here as a student of my master's degree. I got a scholarship. I never intended to stay here. I came to study, like many of us. Like, I see someone now saying nodding as well. We came to do something specific. We have our plans back home. We had our families. And then something happened. In my case, I met my husband. And sadly, that made it, I made the choice that I was going to stay here and I was going to become, I guess, an American. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's very easy to simplify as what you were saying around, you know, what we are and the stereotypes of, you know, the Latinos, and simplifying and looking at the things that you see on TV or the politician tells about the stories of who we are, especially around Latinos and people from Latin America. Everything you hear is about what we don't have. Everything we don't have in our country, so we're coming desperately here. Yes, that is true, and we still are grappling with a lot of that, but many of us, and again, this is part of why I'm so inclined to change the narrative around who we are here in this city, so many of us had our wonderful lives back in our countries. And we came here to take advantage of an opportunity, and we made it home here. And we're thankful for the opportunities, but that doesn't mean that this is the end of all. I'm very critical of the city. The city, I made it my home, and I'm raising my family and my wonderful 10-year-old boy, but it needs to do a lot of work to make it inclusive for all of us. So it's the American dream, I guess, to me, would be to really be understood and welcome as I am, feel visible, feel included, feel like I can be my own Chilean 100% person, mixed with my husband, who is 100% Rocky Riverian, with a wonderful 10-year-old boy who is a mix of both of us, and actually who is gonna become the workforce of this country and the future of this country, as Latinos are one of the fastest growing groups. So, I don't know, that is what to me American dream means.
Let's stay with this, the intentionality of emigration. There are so many people who want to come here, but our faults are laid bare. Karis, do you see people still wanting to come to America given what we now see it as?
Yes, absolutely. I resonate a lot with what you just shared. My own family, I think, came for my, I actually just learned this history recently. My grandmother shared that she moved to the United States from the Philippines with my mom and her siblings because she saw this opportunity. She wanted her kids to grow up with this education. And I do think that despite it all, there is a lot of opportunity here. There are certainly people who want to move here, but like Marcia said, we need to do better. We need to make this place a place that we can all create these spaces of belonging, of connection, of welcome for people, whether they've been here for generations and centuries or moving here as newcomers.
That was just an excerpt of our 90-minute panel conversation from the Cleveland Orchestra's American Dream Festival in partnership with Case Western Reserve University, the City Club of Cleveland, and IdeaStream Public Media. You can watch the entire discussion by going to today's show page, ideastream.org/SOI. To get the last word on today's topics, send us an email, soi@ideastream.org. We're also on Twitter at Sound of Ideas. Follow me there, at RickJ903. From today's first segment, Chris and Mentor writes, I'm concerned that the political climate in Ohio will deter people and companies from staying and locating here. My daughter will not be coming back to Ohio as long as reproductive health is in jeopardy with strict abortion and possibly contraception laws. We have one-party rule in Ohio, which is always dangerous. Thanks for the comment, Chris. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we'll talk about the drive to put a charter issue in front of Cleveland voters in November. PB Clee wants to pass the amendment and put budgeting decisions more into the hands of our citizens. If you missed any portion of this program, you may find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Rick Jackson. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.